Please join me in extending a warm welcome to our special guest tonight, Clint H. from Woodland Hills, California.
Thank you. My name is Clint. I'm an alcoholic. Have we got all the money in? You kind of rushed that a little bit. I think we want to get all the money in and maybe take it through. No, I'm glad to be here tonight. Bring it on over here. Yeah. Thank you very much. Free will love offerings have been... Anybody else want to just... Here, yeah. Thank you. Don't spill it like that. Thank you, Chris, for asking me to come up here. I'm glad to be here. I'm delighted to be here. And I welcome you if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous. Weird, isn't it, to come to a church on a Saturday night to a meeting. If you're new, it's just like, what happened? Man, I was doing so well. And happy birthday to the people that took chips and cakes and so on. Tim, where's Tim? I like that nose thing you got going on, Tim. Some people think that's just kind of a little defiant thing. What happened was that... It's not. The Oregon State Wildlife Commission called him sleeping in the park and tagged his nose and told him to get his ass to AA. So. Is that right? Is that what you told me? Carl picked me up at the airport, and I thank you for that. You wonder who's going to pick you up, and I recognized him right away. I just knew it. Whoa, here we go. Here we go. You never know, really. A few years ago, I was supposed to go to Indianapolis for the weekend, and I did, but I called my office for messages, and the receptionist said, well, you certainly have an interesting life. And I said, well, I do, but what do you think? She said, well, I see there's a note here that says you're going to be in Indianapolis this weekend. And I said, I am, yeah. What's the note saying? She said, well, the guy that's going to pick you up at the airport is going to has a wooden leg and is going to be holding a big book. And I thought, yeah. Sure enough, man, he had a wooden leg. He lost it in some motorcycle accident, his leg, and he carried a big book. And we had a lot of fun. You know, that weekend, we had a lot of fun, this guy. We did. We would, I don't know, he's a drunk and glad to be sober. And I'm a drunk and I'm glad to be sober. And you hook up. You hook up. In fact, when he took me to the airport on Sunday morning after the conference, he had a gift for me. He, and I look in this brown bag and he... It gave me his first wooden foot. And, you know, you... It's... I guess it meant something to him, and it was... gives you a lot to think about. You wonder if you're going to be okay through the security check and all of that. AA is an amazing place. It's an amazing place. And if you're new here, it takes a while to get what's going on in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the last time I drank was on the 14th of August, 1966. So I got, it was a Sunday, as Dan told me tonight. 38 years, and I, like you, if you're new, I did not come in here signed on for 38 years of sobriety. You know, I'll tell you what happened. I was living in a suburb of Los Angeles called Glendale, and I'm like living in a little shed, had four rooms. It was cut up into four rooms, and four guys occupied, and I'm one of them, and I got one of the rooms, and I'm paying $11 a week for the room, and it's got a steel cot in it with a wet mattress, and it's got a bad smell and a sticky linoleum floor, and a lot of fear, a lot of terror in that room, a lot of hopelessness, a lot of a feeling of futility, a deep, deep, pervasive sense of futility. But I didn't know what else to do but just hang in there and drink when I could drink and go to jail when I had to go to jail. And I had been married and I had three kids and I didn't want to see them and didn't want them to see me. And there had been some good days for me. There had been some days that, but that was all over now. I was 29 years old and it was all over, all over. And it had been over for longer than I wanted to admit. It had been over for a long time. And I had picked up the standard scar tissue we do, and I had picked up the kind of a crusty attitude, you know, we don't really want to know how bad it is, and so we kind of develop a little chip on our shoulder, a little kind of a, oh, I planned it this way sort of a look, you know. And I'm saying things to the judge like, guilty, Your Honor. Guilty. And I'm sitting it out on weekends or paying a fine if I had money. I'm writing bad checks and I'm selling encyclopedias door to door. Not often, but... and I'm scared. And I'm scared. And I know how it's going to end. It's going to end. When I had a car, I knew it would end on a freeway abutment. And then I lost the car and... I knew it'd end on Skid Row. The car just disappears. It seems like you know where it is, and one day you don't know where it is. It's gone. That car is gone. And you've been saving up for an oil change, you know, and it's and it's gone. And you make do, you know, you walk is what you do. And you drink. I had been taken by a bail bondsman to the Alano Club of Glendale in July of that year. A guy that I had done business with, and he picked me up on the street and said, I'm going to take you someplace today. And he took me, drove me over to the Alano Club. Whatever that is, there's a sign. And I didn't know what we were doing there, and we went in, and I was treated very kindly by you. Asked to sit down and stay for a meeting, and I did, and I liked you. I liked the lack of pretense. It wasn't, my first thought was it's going to be kind of like church, and it isn't how I remembered church. It isn't that. Because when you spoke, there was an authenticity to it. When you spoke, I knew you had been drinking badly. And it was quite clear you were not drinking and you were okay with not drinking. And of course, I knew that you weren't sober as long as you said. Nobody could be sober that long. I thought maybe they go out to the desert on weekends and get drunk and come back in on Monday. It's funny. It's hard to, when you drink like that and when you have that hopelessness about you, it's hard to imagine that kind of a transition can take place in a human life. And I didn't believe that it had happened for you. It was too much for me to believe that. And I stuck around there. I ran across a little stash of amphetamines and cash in the room one night after 3 weeks. And that calls for a drink, as you know. And I was on a bad drunk for 2 weeks. And I woke up again in the room that drunk. I just was on a around the country kind of a thing. And I woke up in the room on the morning after that last drink. It was the 14th. It was now the 15th. And I walked over to the club in Glendale that day. And I walked up that long flight of stairs, and there's a guy in there doing his job in Alcoholics Anonymous. He was His name is Bill. He died a few months ago. Bill Kennedy was doing his job in AA because the lights were on, the coffee was made, the door was open. And he had a smile on his face, a beautiful, beautiful smile. And I knew that smile would vanish when I told him that I'd gotten drunk. He said, "How you doing?" I said, "I'm not doing good." He said, "What happened?" I said, "I got drunk. Got drunk. Let everybody down, like, I don't know." And he didn't stop smiling. He didn't drill me. I mean, you can say a lot of things in that moment, like, "Did you go to meetings ever? Did you get a sponsor? Did you..." And he didn't do that. He just smiled. He said, "Are you alcoholic?" Isn't that a great question? Are you alcoholic? And I don't know the answer to it. I really didn't know. Seemed likely, but I don't know. Maybe I'm too young. Who knows? But I knew what the right answer was. And so I said, after a moment, I said, "Yeah, I've been an alcoholic about a month now." That's what I told him. Sort of like just caught it, you know, just a mild case, just kind of a toilet seat accident. I don't know what the hell it was, but... He keeps on smiling. He said, "So you're an alcoholic and you got drunk?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "We do that. That's the deal. That's the deal." That day was a watershed day for me because some guy named Bill Kennedy that could not stop smiling, could not stop being delighted to see me. Was delighted to see me. And he let it show. And he wasn't doing anything but doing his job in AA. He said this. He said, "You know, alcoholics, if you're an alcoholic of my type," he said, "you will drink. And you'll drink no matter what. And if you're new here, that may sound a little cold, but it's right." He said, "You'll drink no matter what." Good people in Alcoholics Anonymous are going to tell you, "Don't drink no matter what." You'll drink no matter what. That's what we do. That's what we do. And here we are sitting in a room of couple of hundred people that aren't drinking, many of them alcoholic, many of them not drinking for a long time, and we're people that drink no matter what. We cannot quit. Tom came up here in his spirited reading of chapter 5. You'd think if it was about quitting, they would tell us that. You'd think he would have said, step one, quit. Knock that shit off. That's got to be the answer, doesn't it? It isn't the answer. There are people that come to Alcoholics Anonymous that are not alcoholics of my type. And after a while, they don't drink. But they don't find the magic here. There is nothing miraculous for them here. Because they quit. They quit. Nor should they be here. They leave here. They're just a situational drinker. And after a while, they realize that I don't need this. There's nothing new here for me. And they go out, and they don't need to be here. They shouldn't stay here. They're out tonight shopping, doing something. You know what I mean? But we are the people that cannot quit. And that's worth noticing. If you're new here tonight and you got a couple of days or a couple of weeks of sobriety, that's a big deal. That's a big deal. And it happened so fast. It's like on the 14th of August, I was a drunk and a bad one. And the 15th of August, I didn't drink. That's moving right along. God, that is just boom. Wow. And after a while, you get curious about that power. And you go leafing through this book called Alcoholics Anonymous and it isn't an easy read. It's and Wilson does some stuff like distracting stuff, I think. The goose hung high. What the hell is that, Wilson? The goose hung high. And you put it down, and after a while you pick it up, and you look again. There's a line in here that I think is stunning. It says, our troubles arise out of ourselves. Isn't that amazing? The subtext, the backstory, no one else has to change for me to get free. Isn't that wild? I always wanted people to change so I'd be happy. Isn't that interesting? My life is based on people changing so I'll be okay. I got a lot of security demands in there. I want dead people to change. I want my grandma to change. She's probably not going to change now. I want my mom to change. It's a wild book. In there someplace, Wilson says, God comes to most men gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound. You go, oh, how nice for you, Bill. Oh, no, you and that white light deal. Jesus. And then one day, a year and two and three and four go by. And you pick it up again, and you read it in a slightly different way. You read it not with your head, but someplace else. you connect with it with your heart. Pray that your heart breaks open. And you look and he says, God's impact on me was sudden. And you go, wow, I didn't quit. I was a drunk on the 14th. I was not a drunk on the 15th. Bill Kennedy invited me to sit down and take off my pack and told me that I would drink no matter what. And somewhere in there that day, I surrendered not to God, not to AA, but just knew that I would drink no matter what. And in that moment, something happens. His impact on me was sudden because I never drank again. It was profound because it went right to that little piece in me that always needs a drink and healed it, removed the obsession. And so if you're new here, that all sounds rather fancy, but you look back at a remarkable watershed day. Before that, I'm a drunk. After that, I'm not. And then we kind of make up stories, don't we, about that? I did. Well, I just quit. You know. Really? Well, yeah, you just wake up every morning and you make up your mind. You're not going to drink today. Wow, when did I develop that capacity? Well, I know how you stay sober. You go to lots of meetings and you get commitments and you call your sponsor 7 times a day and you should have 4 sponsors. An ego loves a formula because we can't stand the idea that maybe there's nothing to be done. Maybe the silence is okay. Maybe I'm in God's grace and don't even know that. It's kind of hard to take because we have this awful sense of ourselves. There's something in this book about the great reality is deep within, which leads immediately, if you're looking at it, to, is there a place inside me where I can go where God is? Oh, I don't think so. I don't think I'm a fit host for that. Oh, no. And then you have to look again, and you have to look again. And then somebody says, he's not inside me like a pebble is in a glass of water or a raisin is in a bunny. He's inside me like the ocean is in a wave. That. And gradually, after we've been around here for a while and realize that we're still running our lives and managing our lives, that there may be an easier way. But my God, can you imagine turning your will and your life over to the care of God? I don't think so. We grew up, Carl and I in Billings, lived there for, and we went to the Church of the Air. It's just a non-denominational, deeply fundamental church. They had that crazy name because there was a radio broadcast. And they had some... Christmas got so colorful because they had these stories about Christmas. And they're hard to believe. And you just wonder what to do with them. And they're told to you by people you don't like and don't trust. And yet sometimes today I think about that. I think... occurred to me not long ago that why would the shepherds out in the field get the message first? Isn't that weird? And yet, if you sponsor people, you understand the experience of hearing yourself say something that you don't know you knew. You go, wow, whoa, Jesus. Whoa, that's pretty good. Let me write that. Oh, God's really showing off tonight. I'm doing good. The only common connection is those shepherds are out there tending a flock. And we're in here looking after a new guy. And we get messages we can't get any other way because the power comes through us. And so I started in Alcoholics Anonymous. And after a while, I lost track of the miracle. I decided that I had done something. Then I'm secretary of this meeting, and I'm getting speakers for that meeting, and I'm sponsoring some guys, and I'm like, I don't know what, doing graduate work. I'm looking for power. We're power seekers. Lack of power wouldn't be a dilemma if I didn't really dig power. We need a sense of aliveness, don't we? I mean, I just want to feel alive. That's what the booze and the dope does for us. It gives me a sense of aliveness, or it allows me to forget that I'm not alive, one or the other. And I don't know when we crunch that aliveness out of us. Some of us pretty early in life. Some of us gradually. And we miss it. We miss that. We miss the ability to trust. Somebody said one time that fish swim and birds fly and human beings trust. And it's our birthright to trust. And we are so far away from that that it sounds odd that that's our basic default spiritual condition of a human being, to trust, to trust. When I was 5 years sober, somebody told me I ought to go to law school. And it took a while. And Carl had been a lawyer and a very, very good one for some time. And I had never really thought about it for myself. And then one day I'm in law school and when I'm 9 years sober, I graduate and pass the bar in California. Now I thought I had some power, you know. I don't know. I didn't have any power, but the illusion is there. And you act however you act. Exercise character defects, call it advocacy, and send out a bill. Well, it's better than encyclopedias, you know, it's easier. And then I kind of began to lose. I'm in AA, and I'm sponsoring guys, and I'm... And I've got a problem, because... My mind is the mind that I brought in here. It's not, I don't know much about recovery. Was Luther up here a month or two ago? He said to me one day, called me up. He said, you know what recovery means? We were great at looking things up in the dictionary. I said, what? He said, recovery in the dictionary, one of the definitions is the extraction of something precious out of that which appears to have no value. I went, ooh, ooh. That's very sweet. That's very sweet. So this guy asked me, he said, we're talking about insanity and about being restored to sanity. He said, I know you're not insane, but why don't you write down the 12 craziest things you ever did? Then I went back to him. I trusted this guy, and he seemed to really be raising the issue about the quality of my mind. And I got to writing these things down, and I took my list back to him, and it's just crazy stuff. When I was, I guess, the was right here in Portland. This is kind of the scene of the crime for me. I was a student at Portland State. I was in a beer bar, and there was a pretty gal in there, and I didn't know who she was. I'd never met her before, but she almost looked at me, so I felt we had something to work on, you know. And I looked around again, and she was gone, but I continued to think about her, and I found out where she lived, and at midnight I'm trying to get into her place to discuss our future, basically. And I went to jail that night. I got into the dental school at Oregon for 2 years. Anybody ever get any treatment at the dental school in here? Yeah, I'm sorry. It was a four-year program. They threw me out at the end of 2 years, and they should have. I had, by this time, I always get drunk on Friday night, and they have a clinic on Saturday morning and from 8 o'clock in the morning till noon, and they had just come out with that high-speed air-driven handpiece, and you could, I'm shaking and jumping around and dropping crap on the floor, and you could wipe out a quadrant of teeth just twitching up there with that. I made a set of dentures for a guy my first year up there, and he came up my second year, and he'd see me at the end of the clinic, and he'd go, "Slay." "Something wrong with my teeth," he said. I wrote that down, I told him about it. Got thrown out of there. Drank on Skid Row. It was Burnside Street in those days. Easy drinking. Any Skid Row drinkers here? It's easy, isn't it? I mean, there's no pretense. There's no weird questions like, "How are you?" I came out of a blackout in one of those joints. They call them cafes because there's pickled pig feet on the bar. Sitting across a little carved up table from a lady, I'd never met her before, but I just knew we were together. She had her things in paper sacks. I knew we were together, and I knew we were traveling. And I knew we'd had dinner because she had some chili on her cheek. Isn't that amazing? All I want is power, right? And I got out of there. I wrote that down. I went into the Marine Corps. I'd been getting student deferments. My commander said, I went through Officer Candidate School because they don't let you drink, and I was fine then. And then I get out in the Fleet Marine Force in Camp Pendleton and El Toro, and I'm drunk, and I'm getting letters of reprimand, and a commander said, "Lieutenant Hodges consistently fails to live up to the low standards he set for himself." And you go, I gave him that. And last time I had a drunk driving arrest was back in Southern California. And the cop on the report said, "I discontinued the field sobriety test because the suspect was injuring himself." And you go, and I took my list to this guy, and the issue was my sanity. And he said, "There's a lot of crazy stuff on the list." I said, "Yeah." "A lot of it involves drinking." I said, "Yeah." But he said, "The craziest thing you ever did is not on your list." "Really?" "Yeah." "And what is that?" And he said, "You did it a lot." "Really? What?" "And you did it not drinking. The craziest thing you ever did occurred between two drunks. I said, what? He said, the craziest thing you ever did, with all the evidence in here that you should never drink again, the craziest thing you ever did, sober, between two drunks, was to decide it would be a good idea to take a drink. That's crazy. That is insane. And you did it repeatedly, and you brought that mind with you into Alcoholics Anonymous. And for the first time, I got the idea that there's something else the matter with me. Ray O'Keefe said to his sponsor, there's something else wrong with you. The fact that you're not drinking is not the end of the story. I'm a seeker. And I had turned away from all of this stuff that looked like religion to me. And I'm trying hard to make do and manage my life and make a lot of money and this and that. And those things, I had brought them into my life and they were not making me happy at all, and I'd been sober a while. And I had a lot of anger going on. I was angry at my mom and my grandma and I couldn't have a relationship with a woman. I can't have one. I sat down with a friend of mine named Tom Whalen one night, and another marriage had failed. And he said, what happened this time? I said, I don't know. She just couldn't be intimate. He said, what? I repeated that. He said, who couldn't be intimate? She couldn't. Yeah, I think he asked me about three times when we were in a public restaurant and his volume is going up each time. And I said, Jesus, Tom. He abandoned the question. He finally said, you know what the common event in all of these relationships, the common factor? I said, what? He said, you. You. And I began to open up a little to the possibility that nobody has to change in order for me to get free. And I don't have to do anything. And I'd be with it for a little bit, and then I'd lose it, and I'd be with it for a little bit, and then there'd be a fight, or there'd be something else, or there'd be another. I didn't have relationships. I had arrangements. Have you had any arrangements? That's what we do. We settle for arrangements. It's just a contract. I'll do this, and you do that. And we don't really spell it out, because we don't. We keep score, to be sure. And you know, the simplest one is I'll bring the cash and you bring the sex or whatever it is. But there's all kinds of permutations on that. We try to work out our childhood stuff and all of that. But the problem is that it's a contract with a punitive clause in it. So you know when they've broken the contract and you can be mean or withhold. And if I had told the truth to any of them, I would have said, you know, I know you love me. There were good women. I know you love me. And I can't love you. You see, I didn't get the love that I need when I was a little boy. There's never been enough for me. And so I won't be able to love you. But I'll hang out with you and use you and use the fact that you love me and take advantage of you and strip you of your dignity and lie to you and steal from you. as long as I can, but I won't love you. Had I been able to say the truth and willing to say the truth, it would have been something like that. I had no idea that. And I'm sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my life isn't going that well. In one way it is. I mean, I'm trying naming the paper lawsuits in Los Angeles, and I've got income, and I've got a beautiful house, and it was just hollow and empty. And I'm running hard, and I'm scared. And I'm sponsoring people, and I'm doing the AA dance, but it gets emptier and emptier and emptier. And one day, out of desperation, I thought, maybe I ought to, I know what I'll do. I haven't done much on those steps. Oh, I wrote a little inventory. I wrote some letter. I wrote a letter to a guy that I had been, he and I had been roommates in dental school. And I burned up his couch one night. I was smoking and drunk and had to drag it out into the street. As soon as that night air hits it, it just whoop, and it's really... And I had written him one time after I'd been sober a couple of years and sent him a check and said, I'm so sorry about the couch. And he was thrilled to hear from me, thought I was dead. He wrote me back. He said, I am so glad you're alive and sober. And I told him about AA, and he's glad you're sober. He sent the check back to me. He said, donate it to AA. And maybe someday I will. It could happen. Me. Dennis. And so I decided, feeling so bad, getting everything in my life that I thought would make me happy, it didn't make me happy. But I have an image. God, there's nothing more tedious than a guy with an image. Oh, Jesus. When I was in the Marines, they had us camouflage trucks by putting branches on them so they'd look like trees. And my trucks always look like trucks with branches on them. And with an image, I just look like a donkey trying to keep an image in place. You know, it's really tedious. God Almighty. So I said that third step prayer. That's where I was going to start the road back. I didn't take step one or two or three, any of that. I just said the prayer. And within about 90 days, I lost everything that I had acquired in those years in sobriety. And it stunned me. The house went, and my partner came and said, I don't want to play with you anymore. And he was the guy with the contacts, and I was the trial guy, and suddenly I didn't have any more cases, and my income dropped precipitously. And the lady that I happened to be in the current arrangement with said, I don't want to play with you anymore. And she's out, and the car gets sold, and the house is gone, and the cash flow is gone, and I am more frightened than I have ever been in my life. Drunk or sober. Carl and I come from a family of four kids, and we have a younger sister in Denver, and up until some years ago, we had a little brother, 12 years our junior, and he died. And he died pushing a cart with his clothes in it in Atlanta, Georgia. And he died very angry, not an alcoholic, buddy got beat up once too often and into the hospital. And when he came back, he didn't even have the card. And ultimately, he died. And it was a sad thing because he had a point to prove, as we always do. And the point is, I have been dealt with badly by my parents. I was raised badly. And he was. More than any of the four of us, he took the brunt of it. We kind of escaped with all the survivor guilt that has. But he was stuck and lived an unimaginable life. And when he got free, he wasn't free. He just was angry. And the message of his life seemed to be, do you see what my folks did to me? They treated me right and raised me right with love and caring. Would I have to push this cart? That's the message that we want the world to get. I mean, why am I living in a shed when I'm 29 years old? You know, that's the message, and we want the world to get it, and the world doesn't care. It just goes on doing whatever they're doing, glancing at us, wondering, Jesus. And he died. And I thought I would take that route. I didn't think I'd drink. I just thought I'd be pushing a cart around, and I'm sober years, and I had somehow or other run out of whatever it took. And a guy came along. Talk about God's grace. A man came into my life who knew a lot about this book and about these steps. And he had a friend in Denver. And two or three guys were just kind of taking me through it. And I was frightened enough and despairing enough and failed enough that I was willing to do something I'd never been willing to do before. I was willing to take a chance on this program. I'm not lazy, and neither are you. It wasn't that I was too lazy to take these steps. My thing about the steps is, what if I take them and they don't work for me? Where the hell are we going to go now? Better not to take them. You know, better to just be secretary of another meeting or whatever. And that's good, honest, solid work, and very good people do that work, and I do that work. But in those days, it was kind of my fallback. So I didn't take him, and now I'm told to take him. I mean, and I called the guy up one day, and here's the power of this program, and I don't want to scare anybody, but when I was finally into this and doing these steps and doing what I was supposed to do, I call up my guy in Denver, Don Pritz is his name. And I say, Don, you know, I'm just stunned. I lost everything I had in about 100 days. And he said, yeah. And I said, well, I just don't understand. He said, well, what were you doing just before that happened? And I told him what I just told you. Well, I got scared, and I said the third step, prayer. He said, oh, my God, did you really? He said, that's a powerful prayer. I said, yeah. Yeah, he said, it's a powerful prayer. He said, did you take steps one or two before you got there? I said, no. No, I just thought I ought to start at the third step, prayer. So you were going to, like, kind of buy in on a multi-level marketing deal? Is that? I don't know what it was, but that's where I... And he said, did you read underneath that step where it says we made sure before we took this step that we could actually abandon ourselves to this simple program, or words to that effect? I said, no, I didn't notice that. He said, did you notice in the middle of the step it said we were willing to let go of our image, willing to let it all go in favor of a relationship with God? I said, I didn't notice that. He said, well, the truth of the matter is you took that step. And everything that you had that was more important to you than a better relationship with God went away. Now that's pretty amazing. That's amazing. It says in earlier in the book, it says, is God everything or nothing? Oh, I don't know. If you're going to push me, I'll tell you, I may lie and say he's everything. I don't believe that. If I'm going to tell the truth, I'll say, well, I don't think he's everything, but I don't think he's nothing. And I told them that, these guys that were taking me through the steps, and they said, well, I'll tell you, why don't you just make a list of the five things that are more important to you than a better relationship with God? And I had five things. I had seven things. Well, you know, like greed and control and sex and lust and seven things. Image. Much more important to me than a better relationship with God. That's where I go for my power. And I said, well, that's not going to work very well. We're at step two and you're supposed to be coming up on step three and you're supposed to be making a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand God. And really, the way you have it wired up, God's number eight on a list of eight, right? Yeah. You think you'd turn your will and your life over to number eight on a list of eight? I said, no. Well, it has to be number one. And they showed me exactly how to reprioritize that, and we're only at step two. And step three and four and five and all of that came. And I made those amends, and I knelt at those graves. And I came finally to peace with my mom. Finally to peace with my grandma. I had hated both of them. I stood at my mother's grave when I was 14. Carl and I were 14. I didn't cry. You don't love me. I don't love you. I don't love you. And 2 years later, when I had my first drink, I needed it a lot. So, the funny thing about going through these steps is that Silkworth is right. And the best way, I think, to do it is to just say, all right, I'm the lab rat. I don't believe this crap. I don't believe that this is going to work for me. But I'm willing to give it one shot. I'm willing to do exactly what it says to do in this goofy book. Because these guys said they did this stuff, and they said they got a result, and I want to know if I do this, I'll do more. I'm pushing the envelope. I'm going to do what it says to do. I'm not going to just read it. I'm going to do it. And I'll just see. And if it doesn't, if the promises don't come true for me, I'll know. And I can just forget about that crap. Because I was pretty sure by then I was beyond the pale and I wasn't going to have any kind of a relationship with God ever. And so I entered into this goofy contract with this couple of guys, and I agreed to take the position that everything in there is true, everything applies to me, and just see what happens. And I did that. And it's been the most amazing, amazing part of my sobriety. There is here access to real power. A relationship with God. You kneel at graves and forgive the people of your childhood and you can have a full life. I met my wife Linda after I knelt at that grave in Billings. And that was a watershed day because I came out of that cemetery free. Free. I knew she loved me and always had. I knew I could trust her, and she was always trustworthy. I am her son, and I am of her. And the day never came she didn't love me. And I had lost track of that. I think it goes like this. I think we need a deep sense of aliveness. And one way, and that may be the only way, that we can have that as alcoholics is through knowing that there's a place inside me where I can go where God is. That when I pray from that place. I don't pray. It's like I don't have to believe anything. I don't have to have blind faith. I just experiment with it and see what happens. See if I sleep all night just because I ask. See if I can have peace with my fellows. See if the amends really does brighten the landscape around me, and it does. I want a sense of aliveness, and I will do anything to get it. I think most of the shenanigans that we see in Alcoholics Anonymous, of course the sense of aliveness before we got here was through booze and drugs. After we got here, the sense of aliveness is from something else. The joy of this fellowship. And then there is a time when we have to move into something else, and we come to a place where I have a relationship with God, and there is a sense of aliveness there. And every morning, I work with my wife. She runs my law firm. And sometimes the surrender of the day is no more and no less than getting up from my office and surrendering to the 60 feet between mine and hers and sticking my head in there and say, "Have you got a minute?" "Yeah. I used a nasty tone with you today. I'm so sorry. I know it made you feel bad. Will you forgive that?" "Yes, yes." Sometimes the big surrender of the day is to simply say, "Thy will be done." Because I start out that this is God's will for me. And I want to line up my will with that will. And I don't stay on track. I'm in and out like this all day long. Unless I need a sense of aliveness and I'm over here, and then I notice that that gal in the SUV wants to come into my lane. And then she comes into my lane and I'm angry. And then it occurs to me that other people have done me wrong. And then I remember I didn't get enough respect from that other attorney. And then I remember how stupid that judge was. And then pretty soon I'm out here in the far country looking for a piece of aliveness out there. And I surrender. And then I come back. And then we do it again. The 11th step says, you know, constantly saying to ourselves many times each day, "Thy will be done." And so, just to bring you current, I've had a colorful year. I got that diagnosis that nobody wants to get. And I had to have surgery about 6 months ago. And they took out my prostate. And I'm home from the hospital and I'm feeling bad. I'm just feeling bad. That anesthesia kicks your butt. You don't know what's going to happen. You lose your energy. You're afraid. What's going to happen to my marriage? What's going to happen to my practice? What's going to happen to me? I'm totally absorbed in myself. The phone rings, and a guy from Arizona says, without preamble, "I got a story for you." I recognized his voice. I said, "Yeah." He said there was a guy that loved skydiving. Loved it. Every hour he had that was extra, and every nickel he had that was extra, he is up in a plane skydiving. He loved it. And one day he's up there in the plane, and he's getting his gear laid out. And the door out of which he's going to jump when they get to altitude and when he gets the signal is open. And the pilot's up in the front doing the deal. And the guy doesn't have his parachute on yet. And the plane got lifted with an updraft. And the pilot overcorrected and turned. And our guy went right out that open door without his parachute. And Howard said he had a choice, the same choice that we all do. I said, what is that? He said he could spend the rest of his life in abject fear or delighted to do the thing he loved doing the most. And I went, but I got it. I got it. I got it. What do I love? I love God, and He loves me. I love you. I love Carl, my dear brother Carl. How effective he is here. How wonderful it is to be up here. I love my wife. I love practicing law. And I narrowed it down to that. Do what you love to do. Otherwise, we're going to spend the rest of our lives in abject fear. Do you know when we get tossed out of the airplane? The moment we're born. And so we must learn to love what we do. And it seems to take the edge off of things. About 2 months or three after the surgery, Linda and I went swimming, and we're driving back from the club. She's driving. I said, pull over. I want to talk to you. We need to talk about something. And she said, what? And we were now having fun again and taking, you know, and it was like even. And I said, I got to tell you, we haven't talked about it, but that sex deal is not coming back. And I want you to know two things. I love you more than ever. And I'm at peace with that. And I want to know how you're doing. And she said, I've fallen in love with you all over again. And we're fine. I'm going to miss you terribly. No, she didn't say that. I'm kidding. And we do. We've entered into another relationship and we have a lot of fun. We have an enormous amount of fun. And my life is a life of freedom, a life of service. There's three kinds of prayer we can say. We can say, help me. Oh, we say, help me. We can say, give me, and we do that. But when you get down to it, the real prayer is, use me. And that's the happy part. That's the sweet part. That's the best life I've ever had. Thank you.